Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Catholic Church and the Pope are besieged again, facing a new wave of sexual abuse scandal in Europe and more from the United States. Church officials are pushing back hard, blaming an overzealous press, calling the furor petty gossip and the work of the devil, comparing criticism of the church to persecution of the Jews. But for many, the evidence of deep problems is clear. A new church sex abuse hotline in Germany was swamped with more than 4,000 calls in a single day. So now what? For the church, for its leader, Pope Benedict. This hour on Point, unfinished business in the Catholic Church. Special welcome today to our newest listeners on WILLAM in Urbana, Illinois, just up the road from my hometown. Joining me first today from Rome is Silvia Poggioli, senior European correspondent for National Public Radio. Silvia, welcome back. Thanks very much for joining us. Give us a sense of this weekend in and around the Vatican.
Well, it has been definitely a week of passion for the Vatican. It has been the Vatican Daily and top Vatican officials have throughout the week been coming to a very strong defense of Pope Benedict, who is coming under increasing criticism for allegedly not having done enough to protect children from predator priests, both when he was Archbishop in Munich many years ago and then as head of the Vatican Department that dealt with sex abuse cases in the Catholic Church. Yesterday was the culmination in the Easter ceremony. A very unusual thing happened that nobody remembers having happened before. The Dean of the College of Cardinals, Angelo Sodano, made a special greetings, opened the Mass with a special greeting to the Pope, saying the faithful are with you and they will not be swayed by what he called the petty gossip of the moment. A clear reference to international media reports. In fact, the New York Times has been a particular target of the Vatican in the past week for its articles on this issue.
Let's just get a feel for some of that. Here's Pope Benedict at Easter Mass in St. Peter's Square on Sunday, backed by a choir.
Sit nomen Domini benedictum. Adiutorium nostrum in nomine Domini.
NPR Silvia Poggioli joins us from Rome. Silvia, give us a sense, because it seems to have become important, of the statements in the days leading up to Easter here. You had comments about the devil. You had comments about anti-Semitism. The Vatican distancing itself from some of this. But what was said and what was the aftermath?
Well, one of the most controversial remark of all the statesmen were in the Good Friday Mass at St. Peter's, when the Pope's personal preacher, he's called the Pope, he's been the personal confessor both of Pope Benedict and his predecessor John Paul II, Father Raniero Cantalamessa, gave a sermon in which he compared the attacks, current attacks on the Vatican, on the Catholic Church, on the Pope, to the violence of anti-Semitism that that led to the Holocaust. Not an hour later, the Vatican spokesman, Father Federico Lombardi, immediately distanced himself from the remarks and basically said they were inappropriate and they do not reflect the Vatican position. But to give you a sense of the disarray about what exactly the Vatican message is, that sermon had appeared in full on the front page of the Vatican Daily L'Osservatore Romano. So clearly the reactions were so strong. And of course, if you remember, this is certainly not the first time during the papacy of Pope Benedict that there have been friction between the Catholic Church and Jews, even though this is a pope who prides himself very much for having promoted and carried forth the openings that John Paul II had towards the Jewish people. There had been the case last year where he rehabilitated a traditionalist bishop who was turned out to be a Holocaust denier. This is just the latest, and it certainly angered Jewish leaders from Europe to America to all over the world very, very strongly.
There was criticism quoted from a big advocate of sex abuse victims in the U.S., David Clossy, who called the comparing the church's problems to the persecution of the Jews breathtakingly callous and misguided. He said, men who deliberately and consistently hide child sex crime are in no way victims, and to conflate public scrutiny with horrific violence is about as wrong can be. What do you sense is the what's going on with the Vatican now, Sylvia? Are they is this a full circling of the wagons? Is this a let it blow over moment? The Pope has addressed these problems at points, certainly in his strong message to Ireland, but is there something more? Are they looking at structural changes or hunkering down?
Well, I think it's definitely hunkering down. I think we have to look at this, frankly, from the point of view of a centuries-old culture of secrecy at the Vatican. And there is a sense that, you know, the Vatican priests are to be punished or reprimanded or by the church itself, by church courts, not by civil courts. Essentially, this is a sense that the Vatican, the Catholic Church, has had that they are not subject to the laws of civil society, to the rules of civil society. And the mentality is an old one, a centuries old one. And I think particularly with this Pope, who has surrounded himself with a very small group of men he can trust, but they are not they're not men of the world. And he is a German professor, a theologian. They really seem to be totally, totally out of touch with contemporary society. And as you said, yes, they are hunkering in.
Sylvia Poggioli, it's great to have you. Please stand by in Rome. I want to go to the University of Notre Dame and Scott Appleby, joining us from South Bend, Indiana, professor of history, director of the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies, author of The Ambivalence of the Sacred, editor with Martin Marty of the Fundamentalism Project from the University of Chicago Press. Scott Appleby, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
I don't know what we expected, but to be back in this full sort of gale force storm around the Vatican, maybe this was inevitable, maybe it wasn't. What do you see going on here, Scott? Do we have a church in crisis?
I think we do have a church in crisis, and the crisis has been unfolding since at least 2002. And it's multi-determined in this sense. The church has made a series of mistakes that has allowed an important crisis of the abuse of minors by a minority of priests and the cover-up by bishops, which is enough of a problem in itself. The way the church has handled this problem has exacerbated the crisis. As Sylvia Poggioli just said, in a way, the Vatican doesn't get it. And I want to say some things in support of the Vatican in a moment. What they don't get is that when comments are made in a certain context in the Vatican, like the comments on Good Friday comparing the situation to the persecution of the Jews, or the Pope's speech in Regensburg, which caused a major crisis in his reference to the Prophet Muhammad. There have been a series of incidents in this papacy where they don't seem to understand that what might make sense in a kind of closed context. I think the comment about the Jews was actually probably an attempt to build some kind of solidarity with the Jews. But they don't understand that they're on a world stage, and what we would call politically correct discourse has to at least be genuflected in that one has to genuflect in that direction. So the crisis is real, the substance of it is real, but the Vatican and the way it's handled the world media has exacerbated the problem, including comments by various officials that seem to indicate that they don't get another thing that they don't get, which is the suffering of the victims and the depth, even if it is a minority of priests. Even if the church correctly should be always lauded for its remarkable social service and all the good it does in the world, still the suffering of these victims and the terrible abuse is real, and every single bishop and priest who's asked about it from day one should have begun the statement with that, and that has not been the case.
Sylvia, of course, there's still more coming out in the United States. It's been years that it's been coming out here, and in the most recent round, you know, there's this terrible story of the couple of hundred boys at a school for the deaf in Milwaukee and the abuse that went on there. What about what's come out around Europe? Is it similar to what we saw, all the way back starting in 2002, surging out in the United States? Is it that kind of volume? And what about the European response to this?
Well, Definitely. And every day there have been more allegations. They're coming from, it started, of course, with Ireland. It was a huge case, then Germany. And now they're really coming in from other parts of all over Europe, Netherlands, Switzerland, even here in Italy, where traditionally there has been very, very little coverage of these kind of cases, because clearly the media is much closer to the Vatican and therefore much more easily, should we say, intimidated. And so there's been a lot of silence and on these issues. But now they're beginning, it's beginning to come out here. And as the American Jesuit Father Thomas Rees told me yesterday, you know, the Europeans are kidding themselves if they think that it's all going to end soon. They have hundreds of reports coming out now. If it's going to be like anything like in the United States, it'll turn into the thousands. So, you know, and years ago when the case exploded first in the United States, the attitude here at the Vatican was, oh, it's an American problem. Then it's an Irish problem. Well, now, you know, it's a global Catholic problem. Perhaps something will start coming out of Africa and Latin America soon, too.
Scott Appleby, we just have half a minute before the break, but can the church circle the wagons, hunker down, and let this blow over? Does that look possible to you?
If they follow the lead of the Archbishop of Dublin, Diarmaid Martin, who's been exemplary in this, if they get on the same page and talk about the healing that has to occur, the repentance that has to occur on the part of the church, and the focus on the victims, and eschewing any talk of the church as a victim here. If they get on the page of Martin, who really has been a model, then the church can begin to recover, but they have to get their message right.
Silvio Poggioli mentioned it, but here's the sound of at the Mass preceding the Pope's message on Easter Sunday. Cardinal Angelo Sodano, Dean of the College of Cardinals, dismissed criticism of the Church and the Pope over the abuse scandals.
Holy Father, with you also are the people of God, who are not letting themselves be upset by the petty gossip of the moment.
Petty gossip of the moment. Earlier last week, here's Archbishop of Milwaukee, Jerome Listecki, defending the Vatican in relation to the case of Father Lawrence Murphy, who allegedly abused hundreds of children, deaf children, in Wisconsin over decades. The fault, insisted the Archbishop, lay locally with the local archdiocese.
The mistakes were made here in the Archdiocese of Milwaukee in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, by the church, by civil authorities, by church officials, and by bishops.
And here's Father Michael Notek of Chicago's St. John de La Salle Catholic Church in Chicago telling CBS Sunday Morning this weekend that he has seen regard that priests are held in erode over time.
20 years ago, priests would walk down the street of any major city and people would say, "Good afternoon, Father." They hardly ever do that anymore.
And there's a reason that the church is wrestling with. Silvio Poggioli, Scott Appleby are here. Edward Wilson joins us right now from New York City. He's a member of the Board of Trustees of Voice of the Faithful, an organization of Catholics formed in 2002 to support victims of sexual abuse and call for change in the church. Edward Wilson, thank you very much for being with us.
You're most welcome. I'm happy to be here.
What's the change you're looking for?
Well, I think the first comment I'd make on everything I've heard today and everything I've heard over the past 8 years, really, and I do this myself, is when we refer to the church, we're often talking about the hierarchy and the Pope. And what we need to keep in mind is that we are all the church, all the people of God, all the Catholic people, in fact, the baptized Christian people, comprise the church, and the hierarchy and the clergy are only a small percentage of that,
maybe
2-4%. And that needs to be kept in mind. The second thing is all this blaming of the media reminds me of what Harry Truman said many years ago. He was criticized for being too rough on his political adversaries at the time, and what he said was, "I didn't give them hell. I told the truth, and they thought it was hell." And I think that's a little bit of what's happening now. I would recommend to anybody, Daniel Wakin's story in this morning's New York Times, which is a beautiful analysis of how the church works and what the problems have been. It's worth the price of a year's subscription to the Times. And I have been reading – I obviously cannot read all of the media because it's just too much. But I have been reading the Times, listening to public radio, of course, and to public television and some of the networks. And I find that what the media has generally been doing, and they're not perfect, but they have been telling the truth. They have been giving the facts. And I think that the hierarchy has not been willing to hear the truth, and that's been a problem.
If there's a problem in the way the church works, as I think you hear you suggesting right there, what's the answer? And how deep in the structure of the hierarchy does change need to go, maybe even how high in that hierarchy?
I don't see any limit to how high or how deep it needs to go. But what we need to do is work together to try to do this. Clergy, laity, the lower clergy, everybody needs to work together to try to do something about it. I don't know all of the answers, but we in Voice of the Faithful are working on some of the answers and some of the things, and we will be coming out over the next few weeks and months with some of the suggestions we have. One of the first that we have is we sent a document to Rome, a 26-page document, which was the product of a year of research and consultation about how we might go about improving the method of selecting bishops. Right now, bishops are selected all from Rome. And the papal nuncio, for example, in Washington, sends nominations to Rome, and the pope picks the bishops. We believe this should be done much more locally, and we believe that the laity, and especially the lower clergy, who are going to have to work for the bishop, should have a significant voice in selecting the bishops. We think this would improve the quality of the bishops that we have, and it would also lead to people working together, because now the local church would have ownership in the selection of the bishop that's over them. And I think that would make a huge difference.
That would be
so
a huge...
So that's the kind of thing we ought to be doing.
A huge shift in power right there. Scott Appleby and Sylvia Poggioli, I want to come to you on this. Let's get our listeners engaged. Elizabeth in Boston, you're on the air, Elizabeth.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just posted a comment on your website on this. I've been very active in the church for many years, and I think one of the reasons this story will not go away is that the current government structure of the church is wholly inadequate for the needs of the pastoral needs of the 21st century. And we have often heard in the last 8 years that if women and married men were involved in the leadership of the church, we would not have had the tragic extents of the abuse crisis and the whole crisis that's followed. And I think that we know in our church that leadership in the church is tied to ordination to the priesthood. And rather than we suffer a crisis, 1 in 5 parishes in the country right now is without a resident priest. We don't have enough celibate men to be priests. And rather than address this issue, the bishops are willing to close parishes left and right rather than open the priesthood. The justification for excluding women from the priesthood is Jesus' choice of the 12. Which was a choice to say that the 12 represented continuity with the 12 tribes of Israel. And it was an effort by Jesus to include people, rather to exclude women from leadership. And if you read the New Testament, Paul regularly talks about the women who led local churches. Phoebe, the deacon of Cenchreae in Romans 16, many women mentioned in Romans 16. She is never mentioned in the Catholic lectionary year A, B, or C.
But Elizabeth, we get a sense of the breadth.
We have to. There are some signs of the possibility. Even Christoph Schönborn, the conservative cardinal of Vienna, suggested recently we might have to re-examine, make celibacy optional again.
Elizabeth, let me take it to our panelist, Scott Appleby. I'll come first to you. If it's going to come to structural change, and it may not, we'll come back to that. But if it were to go there, what are the elements you'd look at? What are the elements that are on the table? You heard a lot that was explicit and implicit in what Elizabeth's saying right there, from looking at celibacy and married priests, women priests. You heard Ed Wilson saying we have to change the way bishops are named, get the laity involved. Is that on the table? Could some of this happen? What would it take, Scott?
Let me just say that if Elizabeth presented herself as a regular caller, she's a ringer, because she sounds to me like a pretty well-trained theologian. That is to say, the range of reform she just suggested were on the table, perhaps, or on a corner of the table some years ago. I don't think there is active issues for the Vatican and for the hierarchy today as they might have been a decade ago, and here's why. I agree with much of what Elizabeth said, that the structure of leadership in the church and governance needs to be reformed, to be rethought. I've always said since 2002 that the deeper problem with this sexual abuse scandal, some say it's homosexuality, lack of married priests, lack of women priests. I think those I don't agree that homosexuality has much at all to do with this. I think it's about power, immaturity, sin, not homosexuality. Nonetheless, my larger point is the problem is clericalism in the church. That is, the notion that the priesthood is a tightly knit band of men who have a special status over the laity. In fact, that's the theology of the priesthood, that priests are alter Christus, another Christ, and that ordination puts a mark on their soul that sets them apart from other people. My comment is not so much to challenge that theology as such, but rather to say that the culture that has grown around it has reinforced the notion among many priests, not all of them, but many priests, that they are set apart and that rules that apply to the laity, no one would admit this, I think, explicitly, but the impression is that the rules that apply to the rest of the church, the type of conduct does not apply to them. And let me just tie in one other question, one other comment, and that's about the media. The media is not innocent in this regard, and it one of the implications or one of the effects of it has been to reinforce clericalism because some of the attacks of the media have indeed been unbalanced. The current editor of the New York Times, Bill Keller, wrote an op-ed years ago at the end of John Paul II's pontificate before he became editor that likened John Paul II to Hitler and Stalin. It was ludicrous, just outrageous. So when people say the New York Times has it in for the Catholic Church, I don't think that's true overall for all the reporters, but there's evidence that the New York Times opposes the church in various of its policies and sees it as a retrograde, rear guard, a regressive institution that needs to be taken down. Also,
that's a pretty big comment that needs to be taken down. The church needs to be taken down. You think that's
Go look at the editor of the New York Times op-ed.
How many years ago?
It was right at the end of John Paul II's reign. I mean, and he's comparing he didn't like John Paul's policies, and he compared John Paul II to Hitler and Stalin, a totalitarian leader with no sense of human dignity. It's just outrageous. There are things to criticize, but on the other hand, and I'm not suggesting that everything the Times does is of this caliber, but those who say there is a focus, an unbalanced focus on this, and it's a terrible issue, don't misunderstand me, but how often does the New York Times or the media in general say anything about the largely positive record of the church on so many issues? That's not part of the coverage.
Sylvia Poggioli, the Pope himself has come in for a lot of criticism in this latest chapter. What are the primary sources of that criticism, Sylvia?
Well, we're hearing reports. There was, as you mentioned, the case of the Wisconsin priest at the School of the Deaf. From what I understand, the New York Times had certain documents which come from the lawyers, produced by the lawyers, that show that efforts were made to get, at that time, then Cardinal Ratzinger, at the head of the Congregation of the Faith that dealt with sex abuse cases, to deal with that case. And apparently the priest himself, Father Murphy, sent Ratzinger a letter saying, "I'm not well, please leave me alone." And the case was apparently dropped at Cardinal Ratzinger's behest. There's another case in Munich when the current pope was archbishop there. Again, these are all coming out. Those are coming out from Germany. But the thing is that I wanted to get back to what Mr. Wilson said about, you know, the changes. I think this is also certainly what is being discussed very much now at the grassroots level in Europe. Definitely people are talking about trying to see something positive may come out of this, because already a kind of there's so much upheaval in the church at the base that people feel that there are going to be changes, whether they are dictated from the top, from the hierarchy or not. And there's beginning to be talk of actually even holding some kind of a third Vatican Council. Perhaps it will not be Pope Benedict who will convene such a council, but perhaps a successor pope will. And definitely the issue of all those reforms that had been promoted by the Second Vatican Council, which were decentralization and greater power to the laity, both men and women, are now definitely being raised again, saying this is the time finally to implement those reforms.
Edward Wilson, do you see this Pope Benedict as an ally in your call for structural change in the hierarchy of the church, or not?
Not yet. I hope he will be, but he has not been so far. I will say, however, that he has been a marked improvement over the record of John Paul II, and in the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith and as Pope, he has done and said things that his predecessors did not. That being said, I don't see him as having shown thus far much interest in changing the culture of secrecy, really arrogance and unaccountability on the part of the hierarchy. I have not seen that, but we are hopeful that he will do that. That's why Voice of the Faithful has not called for the resignation of the Pope. We think he could, if so inclined, do a lot of good, and we hope that he might be somewhat chastened by the stories which have come out, some of them touching him personally, and understand the need to do this. He has the breadth of experience and knowledge of the Church inside and out to be capable of doing it if he wishes to do that. We are not holding our breath waiting for that.
Scott Appleby, let me ask just, this is an ignorant question, I guess, but can a pope, can the pope resign? Is that even a possibility if it would ever come to such a thing?
Of course, they can resign. Pope Celestine V resigned after the person who succeeded him sent his agents to the papal window outside the Celestine's bedroom and whispered, "You are not worthy, you are not worthy." Celestine was a very holy monk, and the more power-hungry successor wanted him to resign, and indeed he did resign because he didn't feel he was called to the papacy. So there are many historical precedents for this, and the Pope could well resign. That's certainly within his ability.
When you say could well, you mean just it's possible within the governing rules or laws of the Church. You're not predicting.
Oh
that.
Yes, right. There's nothing that would prohibit a Pope from resigning for a variety of reasons.
Sylvia, people have raised this idea, with different degrees of seriousness around the world. Is there talk of this in Rome, or is that way out in left field?
Way out in left field. Mm-hmm. There's absolutely no likelihood that I think Pope Benedict is going to resign. I think perhaps it's also, that's one of those rather counterproductive arguments. I mean, the point is to see really whether this papacy, this hierarchy, is willing to proceed with some structural changes. Perhaps that's possible. I'm not so sure that will happen under this papacy either. But no, I don't think there's any chance he's going to resign.
And structural change itself looks unlikely to you under a pope who's not been that many years here in his office.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think immediately. It depends now where this goes because, well, you know, it has to be said, you know, as Mr. Wilson said, Pope Benedict has gone further than John Paul on this issue. Mm-hmm. He has met with victims of priestly sex abuse, mm-hmm. both in the United States and in Ireland. There's a very good possibility he will talk about it in 2 weeks when he goes to visit Malta, where there are new revelations are emerging there, and sex abuse victims there are demanding an apology for him. But, you know, even in his letter to the Irish, mm-hmm. at the end of March, he said some extraordinarily important things and apologized for the Church. But what the victims want is some kind of accountability, some kind of punishment of those who are responsible. And that has not yet come. That is a step that this Pope has not yet made, really calling for accountability of the bishop. He blamed all the Irish bishops for all of them. He blamed Irish bishops for mishandling the crisis, but he did not take a step further than that.
Let's go to Steve in Norfolk, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate it. I'm mm-hmm. really enjoying the discussion. And I guess I'm a devout Catholic. Mm-hmm. Still am, and although that I find these revelations very, very disturbing, it really hasn't shaken my faith. But I think one of the frustrations is that this kind of discussion that you're having on the program is not going on as far as I know, on a widespread basis, is not going on within the parishes in the country. And I think this is one of the problems, is that Catholic laity who want to be brought into the discussion more aren't able to do that. The Church really hasn't involved them in that. And I'm not necessarily saying in the governance. I think there's some good ideas there. I'm afraid there's going to be a push to push that too far. But I think there's got to be an opening up in terms of discussion, hearing the frustration, hearing the points of view of the laity, and that's not going on.
Steve, I appreciate your call. Edward Wilson, how can that be that with this level of crisis, well, first of all, do you agree with this, Steve, that the conversation about change and sort of facing issues in the church is not going on? And if not, how can it be that it's not at this point in this crisis?
Unfortunately, I think I do in large measure agree with Steve. It's not true in all parishes. It's not true in my particular parish in Brooklyn, New York, mm-hmm. where we do talk about things. But first of all, most of the people in the Voice of the Faithful are older, we're retired, and we have the time to devote to this. When I was in my 30s and 40s, raising children, having a legal career, I was not able to devote this kind of time. Now I can. So I think that's part of the problem. Part of the problem is I think some people have the attitude, we don't care what's happening in Rome. We don't care what the hierarchy is doing. We're going to go to Mass. We're going to go to communion. We're not going to pay attention to all this stuff. We really don't want to hear about it. We don't want to hear about priests doing this kind of thing. And then there is the pray, pay, and obey mentality, which still unfortunately exists among many Catholics. We were originally in the United States an immigrant church. People, the most educated people around were the priests, and we tended to listen to them. That was somewhat true even when I was in grade school and high school and college. That has been changing, and now Catholics are everywhere in the society, and we are as well educated as our clergy. And I think a lot of the clergy have a lot of problem understanding that we're as well educated as they are, and we have people like Scott Appleby who are scholars just as knowledgeable about the church.
But if lay Catholics are putting their heads down and getting on with it, going to Mass, pray, pay, and obey is still kind of in effect there. Is it possible that maybe the Vatican is right? Maybe they can circle the wagons and just weather this storm, Ed?
I hope not. And it seems to me that if the current storm does not induce some of the people in the hierarchy to wake up, I don't know what will, but the attacks on the media, and I agree with Scott that the Times hasn't always been good, but I have been following their reporting in the last few weeks, and I think Laurie Goodstein and Dan Wakin and the people in Europe have done a good job of sticking to the facts and sticking to documents that they've found. What Keller said was awful, but that was then.
Let's go to Tom in Elkhorn, Nebraska. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was raised Catholic, and unfortunately the Catholic Church lost me a long time ago. So what's going on in Europe is kind of business as usual. And it's kind of like politics. It's not just the crime, but it's the cover-up as well. So I think to solve this problem, the Catholic Church needs some radical changes, new pope, new cardinals, new bishops. And I think that could possibly get me and a lot of other Catholics back.
Radical change, you say, Tom. We'll look at it in Joanna in Boston. You're on the air, Joanna.
Hi there, Tom. I'm a young mother, and I live in Boston. And I wanted to say that, you know, 10 years ago when it broke in the Globe, the story of what was going on and the scandal, I was horrified by it, but I kept going along. But now it's much different for me that I'm a young mother. It's much harder to swallow, and I myself am not a victim of abuse, but I have a friend who is, and not of priest abuse, but just the sexual assault survivor, and she's a devout Catholic like me, but she's saying that watching the reaction from the Vatican is really shaking her face. And I thought, you know, this isn't really quite as profound as what's being said on the air right now, but I thought, you know, how they teach children in school, well, what would Jesus do? Well, maybe the Vatican needs to change that and say, well, what would Mary do? Because there's no way a mother that would be in charge of any of this would let this go on and let these kind of reactions be said.
Joanna, thank you very much for your call. Scott Appleby, I wonder what you're thinking here as you hear our callers, and also this issue of whether or not the church can hunker down. Sylvia Poggioli saying it looks difficult, but you know, if there's enough tolerance, I suppose they could try it. What do you think will unfold here? What are the chances of a real deep structural reconsideration?
I think if you look at it politically, realistically, you wouldn't be holding your breath for anything to happen right away. When Ed mentioned a moment ago that he and the Voice of the Faithful folks are older and have the time, that's one of the characteristics. On the other hand, there was a moment after Vatican II that sadly has passed when the momentum of the council toward lay involvement, collegiality among the bishops themselves, offered hope for real structural reform, and then Pope John Paul II, during his pontificate, really undermined that kind of growing sense of lay involvement in the church and collegiality. On the other hand, 2 weeks ago or so, I was in Rome, and on the front page of L'Osservatore Romano, the Vatican's own newspaper, there was an editorial that made the point that was just made, namely that if there had been more women involved in the upper governance of the church, that doesn't mean they'd necessarily be priests or cardinals, but if women had had greater authority in the church, this sexual abuse scandal would not have happened to the degree it has occurred. There would have not have been the abuse of children because women would have been much better at protecting children. Now, that came from the Vatican's own newspaper. And there are people, I mentioned before, Archbishop Martin in Dublin, there are people working for reform in the church who are aware of the problems. The challenge is that those folks are not necessarily in the system, in the Curia, in the Vatican. And the mentality there still is far too closed, and it's kind of in its own, I think, its own dynamics. To some extent, that's always going to be the case, but I wouldn't exclude the possibility of surprising movements of reform from within the hierarchy itself, because everyone realizes that the church is on its knees and something has to be done.
Sylvia Poggioli, do you feel that realization, the church is on its knees? Do you see in your reporting on the Vatican forces moving toward significant reform or mainly resisting?
Not certainly from the top, but I have to say there's something else. There's certain European countries, Germany and Austria, that keep registries, their government registries of people's of their religious affiliation, mm-hmm. and it seems that the reports are that in the last few months there's been a huge exodus from the Catholic Church in Germany and Austria. So that's one thing I certainly think the hierarchy has to keep in mind. Another thing is, as I say, definitely there's going to be a pressure for the pressure for change is mounting enormously from the grassroots level, from the laity, from parish. But as one priest also told me, the likelihood, and then there's another thing, for instance, even Cardinal Maria Martini of Milan has been pushing a lot for beginning a debate on celibacy, even before this whole the whole scandal exploded. So, but from what I'm hearing from priests is that there would be more likelihood of the possibility of married priests before there will be women priests in the Catholic Church.
Scott, can you imagine that happening, allowing married priests, doing away with celibacy as a requirement for priests?
Oh, I certainly can imagine it. It's not a revealed doctrine of the Church. It's a disciplinary matter that could be revoked. If momentum, people have suggested that the church could retain celibacy for the religious orders, which have a different calling than the parish priest, the diocesan or secular mm-hmm. priest, and allow diocesan priests to be married, and that would be one way of preserving celibacy for certain of the clergy, but also acknowledging the need for more priests and for priests who come from a background that is more in touch with the everyday lives of lay Catholics.
Ed Wilson, what about the doing away with the celibacy requirement, at least for parish priests? At Voice of the Faithful, do you see that as something that might, change the church local representation in a way that would move away from the kind of large-scale, widespread sexual abuse we've seen?
We think it might help. We haven't called for ending the discipline of celibacy, but we have called for a church-wide discussion of the condition and morale of the priesthood, which from all accounts we hear from our friends who are priests is just terrible in the United States, and I expect it's probably true in Europe and elsewhere also. And it needs to be understood that the church has not strictly enforced celibacy. They have let in a whole hundreds of Anglican priests, and they just have a new enterprise whereby they're bringing in the whole sections of the Anglican Church, which will include married priests. The Eastern Rite priests have always been married, and that's been going on for many years. And for the first 1,000 years of the Church, priests and popes were married. St. Peter had a mother-in-law. We believe most of the apostles were married. And so there's no reason why this can't be done. What effect it would have, I think it would increase the population of priests somewhat. I doubt that it would solve the shortage, but it would give priests a perspective that they don't have now, and I think that would be very valuable.
Heidi in Burlington, Vermont. Heidi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I just want to make a comment that
you know, whether or not a priest is married is not going to change whether or not they are a pedophile or somebody who gets satisfaction and power and the sense of power over somebody else from sexual abuse. I'm a survivor of sexual abuse. I'm not through the church, but I am also a board member on our rape crisis program here in Chittenden County. And the one thing that always strikes me about this issue is that changing the requirements about marriage or not does not matter. Sex isn't what rape is about. It's about power, control, and violence. And what the church really needs and what I think you need on this program is an expert on sexual violence to understand why it happens, what the mechanisms of denial are, like covering it up and keeping, you know, keeping priests in the churchhood, whether or not they are pedophiles. You have to find out what's at the root of this problem. It's not about just the church. It happens in all sorts of different institutions. It happens in the White House. It happens in police academies. I mean, it happens everywhere. So it's not specific to the church, and the church needs to educate itself about what sexual violence really is.
Heidi, thank you very much for that. Scott Appleby, what about it? The scale of the problem in the church, and Heidi's quite right, it occurs in other places, but here it went for so long undercover, denied, kept secret. What do you attribute that to? To secrecy itself? To the way power is apportioned in the Catholic Church? What, Scott?
First, let me say that I think Heidi is exactly right, that we need to know more about the dynamics of sexual violence, and it is very much, I think, about power. And so to your question, Tom, back to my little mantra, which is clericalism. I think what creates a climate within the church that in the past, at least, I think this is changing, but in the past, at least, what created a climate in the church that allowed the secrecy, the reassignments, the failure to fully understand the dynamics of sexual violence or even to want to understand it is a sense that the priesthood is somewhat under siege to begin with, and it is the center of the church. You've heard bishops recently, I think Archbishop Dolan said of New York, that the church would not exist without the ordained male priesthood. That I may be falsely attributing that to Archbishop Dolan, but I'm sure he agrees with that. And in a sense, that's true, but that has become such a focus of the circling wagons mentality and the sense that the priesthood itself is under siege. And I agree, there's a morale problem among so many priests who are not so caught up in these power dynamics, but they are themselves unfortunate consequences occur to them as a result of the power dynamics within the priesthood, which unfortunately, in that kind of clericalism, has distanced many priests from women, from laity, from the larger church, which, as Ed said, is 95% of the Catholic faithful, and therefore the climate has been created that allows people to look the other way when they know much better than that, that a crime and a terrible sin is being committed, but we have to protect our own.
It wouldn't help morale, but what about secular criminal charges as a way of clearing the air? I mean, that's what happens in schools and businesses when these things are exposed.
Right. Yeah, I must say that despite all the terrible trauma and tumult in the U.S. church as a result of the sexual abuse scandal that broke in 2002, I believe that the bishops took a step forward in the charter they created to protect children and young adults from abuse. They implemented policies that bars credibly accused priests from any public church work while claims against them are under investigation, and barring clergy from public ministry found guilty, ousting them from the priesthood when that can happen, a zero-tolerance policy, and an involvement of lay boards in determining culpability. There are many other features to that charter, but there was a step forward, I think, very courageously taken by Wilton Gregory and Archbishop Flynn and others who led reform within the U.S. church. That's a beginning, and I think Europe and the broader church could actually learn from the agony and then the reforms that were instituted. They're not perfect. There's been some criticism of them, but claims that have been the claims are down. There is empirical evidence that these reforms have begun to work, and that's a sign of hope.
Sylvia Poggioli, it's been so good to have you with us today. Do you see some answer, some similar response in Europe? And do you see bigger change coming in the church or not, Sylvia?
Well, so far, none of the European churches have taken exactly the steps, the American bishop steps, the zero tolerance policy. There's a lot of there are many calls that they absolutely, you know, take the American example and start implementing. It has not happened yet. But as I say, I think there's a lot of ferment now in the European church. And you're beginning to hear bishops and cardinals during their Easter masses. They were acknowledging mismanagement of the entire crisis and were voicing dismay over the culture of secrecy.
Sylvia Poggioli, senior European correspondent for NPR in Rome. Thank you so much for being with us, Sylvia. Scott Appleby at Notre Dame, thanks for joining us today, Scott.
Thank you, Tom.
And Edward Wilson with Voice of the Faithful, thank you for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.